Hello, welcome to We Cut Heads, a Spike Lee podcast. I'm your host, Spencer, and with me is, it's a bit of a special episode because we're going to talk about pies, because the movie is Secrets and Pies. So, Joel, what's your favorite type of pie?
A banana cream pie, although I am a kind of a sucker for lemon meringue, you know, but that's a... You can't eat too much lemon meringue pie before you get sick. Now, a banana cream pie, I could just nail that. I'll probably get sick anyways, but hey, wait, that's not what this movie was. You're thinking of that movie with Josh Brolin and Kate Winslet.
No. Wait. What was the movie, Secrets and Lies or Pies? Yeah.
No. You watched your DVD standard edition full screen copy of Labor Day.
Oh, well, sorry, John. I guess I watched the wrong movie.
Well, that's all my research out the window.
All right, but, those stupid jokes aside, this is the second half of the 1996 pairing. First was Girl 6 with, Dave Stone Rob. Has not been recorded yet as of now. But this is Secrets and Lies, the Mike Lee movie that won the Palme d'Or that year. And so, John, when I sent you the list of for the movies we're going to cover, what made you want to pick this movie?
Oh, I love this movie. I love Mike Lee. He's absolutely one of the greatest filmmakers of his generation, of his time. Something that we like to say over the Pink Smoke is that when a Mike Lee movie comes out, a brand new one, it's almost like, do other filmmakers watch this and think, why do I bother? You know, this movie is so fucking perfect and so good. What am I even doing out there? If someone like Mike Lee is constantly churning out masterpieces, you know, every few years, it just seems like it would be despairing for all of the filmmakers to have Mike Lee as one of their contemporaries.
Yeah, this is the first Mike Lee movie. Did you say who you are yet?
I didn't. I'm John Cribbs. I'm the head writer for thepinksmoke.com and recurring guest. How's it going, guys?
As good as it can be after watching this movie.
I am emotionally distraught.
Is this the first time watch for both of you guys?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I've known the name Mike Lee for a couple years, and pretty much like Naked, because that's like the famous one everyone talks about, and Happy Go Lucky, I kind of stumbled, I saw a clip or two of it somewhere, or tried to watch it in high school. When did that come out? 2008. So Happy Go Lucky kind of had some interaction with at some point, but this is the first Mike Lee movie I've actually seen.
Here's a tip about Naked. Never suggest renting it to a household of people that you're staying at that you don't really know very well and watch it with them. This happened to me when I was staying in San Francisco once with a bunch of people who seemed like cool people. They were all artists. They were an assortment of performance artists and like stand-up comedians and stuff, and we just happened to be at the video store. They're looking for a movie for the night. I was like, and then Naked was on the shelf. I was like, oh, this movie is fucking fantastic. You guys have got to watch this one. Bad choice for a bunch of people you don't know. If you want to talk about just a movie that's going to emotionally tear off your testicles and make you watch as they scrunch them on the floor. best to keep that kind of a film to people that you know. Just a word of advice.
Oh, okay.
People who deserve that kind of punishment.
Exactly. People that you don't worry about, don't really care about hurting emotionally.
Right, yeah.
You know, brothers, sisters, friends.
Yeah. I heard the wrong reel on it whenever the Criterion came out, and it sounds like a pretty rough movie in general.
It's a challenging film, for sure. But it's great.
They made an animated series out of it?
Not that I'm aware of.
Oh, I thought Spencer just said the cartoon came out of it.
Criterion.
Oh, I'm sorry.
I think that's, yeah, something like that.
It lends itself to an animated series, so that wouldn't surprise me.
I mean, like, you know, they had a bunch of animated series that would just, you know, make you cross your eyes if you think too much about it, so it wouldn't be that surprising.
Yeah. But, is that voice coming through clear?
Yep.
Because last time I recorded, apparently it didn't recognize my microphone. It used like the microphone in the laptop.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. So, double checking because something came up, but I think it should be okay. Okay, so John, so you're a bit of a Mike Lee super fan. So like, how would you pitch Mike Lee to someone who hasn't to people like me and Joel who are just like this or first one, like how would you sum him up?
If I had to sum up Mike Lee, I would just say that his biggest interest is happiness, specifically people who he almost has characters who are a scale of people in terms of like how easy it is for them to afford happiness as opposed to ones who for some reason just can never be happy. And I think he kind of is interested in a world where, for some people, being happy is just as easy as, you know, walking or breathing. And for other people, for some reason, it's an insurmountable mountain. And they're just kind of crushed by their own emotional baggage. So I think all of his films, you know, he comes from a theatrical background where he workshops with actors. He does a lot of improv where he basically assigns characters to people and then lets them develop that character on their own and then comes up with these scenarios to put these characters in which, you know, things will naturally lead up to a dramatic confrontation. And after he's workshopped it and figured out all the kind of plot twists and things like that, he will actually script the film and then they'll actually make the movie. So for a long time, he went by the credit devised and directed by Mike Lee, meaning, you know, he's the one who kind of put it all together as opposed to the one who actually wrote it because he worked, collaborated with all these actors to make this film. But these days, he kind of just reverts back to written and directed by because he really is the author of the screenplay. He really is the one who puts it all together. So that's pretty much how he's done every single film. And again, it's sort of a secretive process that he, between him and his recurring cast members, that he sets up in a, you know, his own secret filmmaking laboratory, and no one really knows the exact way that he does it, but movies like Secrets and Lies are what come out of it. Months and months of rehearsing and developing these characters together. So it's a very unique style, obviously. He first took it to BBC and made a lot of television films over 20 years, and then came back to feature filmmaking, and since 1988 with High Hopes, yeah, he's been back doing feature films and does a film every, you know, 2 to 3 years, basically.
Oh, okay. But, yeah, so...
But if I'm pitching it to people specifically, I guess, other than just giving background, I would say that Mike Lee is, you know, a guy who can effortlessly get emotional scenes out of his actors and, you know, have really powerful, really familiar, very relatable scenarios, but he's also incredibly smart and funny. So it never reverts to caricature, even when his actors are kind of doing, you know, a hyper, you know, performance or they're kind of going over the top a little bit. He is able to rein it in, so it's not too much. You know, it's all sort of grounded, but really funny and clever at the same time. So it's a little something for everybody, I think.
It does feel kind of theatrical, like this kind of like the where it's like there's not too much of it, like a heavy plot. It's kind of like it's like it feels like, you know, like Secret Lives could easily have been turned into a play, unless maybe it was a play because you said he or had some, or maybe it's partially inspired because you said he did come from theater. before filmmaking and TV.
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely a minimalism to, I think, all the settings and not a huge cast of characters often, but at the same time, the background that is developed for these characters is very deep. You know, it's very complicated, and especially in a film like Secrets and Lies, where the relationships of these people is part of sort of the web that they're all entangling throughout, you know, and by the end, everyone kind of knows all these secrets that they've been keeping from each other and their whole lives, you know, and it's sort of also the key to their personal relationship. So it's not just, you know, twists, you know, in the plot or anything like that. It's like Cynthia's relationship with Roxanne is unlocked by Hortense showing up, her other daughter that she gave up at birth. By coming back, it's not just, you know, a twist that like, oh my God, she had a daughter. It's like everything that's going on in her relationship with her second daughter that who grew up with her, who she actually raised, is based on this character returning. And everything that involves Timothy Spall's character, Morris Pearly, and his wife, Monica, also kind of is tied into all of that. So it's a really intricate sort of thing that's been set up here that, you know, Mike Leigh kind of sets up and knocks down by the end of the movie. So even though it's sort of sparse in terms of the actual scenario, there's just a lot. There's a deep well emotionally in terms of the background.
Yeah, like it sounds like heavy. It is heavy, but it sounds like art housey, like in a bad way. But it's also very human, because like they go see like Judge Dredd, and they talk about like Stallone, and it's like, oh, I did not expect like that to come up in conversation, or have like, you know, like, let's have a moment, like, or like they talk about like Stallone, or a moment where there's another like very unexpected. What was it? I can't remember what the other thing specifically was. Well, like it's just this, like very like universal and human, and then in that way, like Kurosawa, like as that's like very universal and human, and like it doesn't you can just come at it from any from like any point and connect to it.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that's a big part of the sort of the organic construction of these films, is that, you know, the actors are encouraged to bring stuff from their real life, to either base it on a real person that they know, or take things for their character from, you know, their own experience. But whatever it is, you know, a lot of the actors, if they work, you know, as an optometrist, like Hortense does in this film, like Marianne Jean-Baptiste's character does in this film, she actually went and worked as an optometrist, like learned how to do it, you know? So there's a real, you know, process here where they're really absorbed into these characters, and I think that a lot of the familiarity with it comes from that. They really have lived these lives for several months before they actually start filming them.
Yeah, sounds like the Dardenne brothers a little bit, their approach, but I don't know if the Dardennes came from theater, but it sounds like, from what I remember, on like this extra features on the Rosetta disc, where they're talking about like having the, where like the actor, like the one, where like the one guy who played like the waffle person, like he actually learned how to make waffles to get into character and like understand how to like, you know, you know, I'm trying to get at.
Sure, and I think Kieslowski too had something like that, where a bunch of his actors would kind of go and live in this area or this town that they were shooting in, and kind of become part of the background, especially for the Trey Colors trilogy, where a lot of the people that you see in both films, you know, the kind of connectivity between them is based on the fact that a lot of these people actually, you know, were living in set, as it were, like they just kind of become part of that world.
Joel, are you still there?
Yes, I'm enjoying the conversation. Continue.
Okay. Do you have anything to add?
Well, I think that one of the more interesting things about the movie, this having not seen anything, any of his other movies, I now really want to see a bunch of them, because the way he tied everything together at the end, you know, with the whole party scene, just felt like this masterful sweep of thing, because like, even though these characters were all remotely connected in some way, and, you know, more and more encroaching on each other's plot lines and stuff like that, like, it could have been a different situation at the end, you know, when the daughter leaves her birthday party because she's upset, and that, you know, the reveal of this, her having this half sister and stuff like that. Like, having Timothy Spall also have a slight explosion because, you know, that, like, why does his wife hate his sister and all these other things like that? Why isn't their marriage working? And then, like, I feel like such a good ribbon is put on at the end with the two sisters kind of hanging out and having this, like, natural rapport with each other, and the mom seeming to take peace just from being around everybody. Like, I don't know. What I read on IMDb is that most of this movie was, like, ad-libbed, and that's kind of mind-blowing. Is that true?
Well, again, it starts as ad-libbing. It starts as these people developing these characters, then coming together with a scenario, and everything is improvised, and then things are thrown out there. A good example is nobody knew, none of these actors when they were, excuse me, none of these actors when they were rehearsing knew who Hortense was. You know, the actors didn't, and not just the characters, only Cynthia and Blenda Blethrin, the actress playing her, knew the background. So when they rehearsed and put together this party where they come together at the end, when it's revealed who she really is, that she's this baby that Cynthia had given up for adoption, those actors were reacting to that for the first time because they didn't know. And another good example during that scene, too, is that when Roxanne flees the house, where she goes to the bus stop, that was that actress's natural reaction in rehearsal. She got up and left the house. And Mike Lee was like, oh no, we need to get her character back here to end this movie. So they had to devise, okay, well, we'll do another improv at the bus stop where we'll have Timothy Spall come up to her and sit down and talk to her and try to convince her to come back. And she wouldn't. She as the character would not come back to the house. They couldn't figure out a way. And so finally they decided that the boyfriend, right, the scaffolder who's with her, if he suggested that she go back, which was kind of took her aback, because this whole movie he has just been sort of this background guy who has not, you know, had anything to do with the action going on, that he actually takes a stance and says, you should go back. That's what would get that character back into the house. So that's how these films develop, is that they actually, you know, figure out ways to get where they need to go. So, yes, it was improvised initially, but by the time they go through all those months and months of improvisation, it's all scripted. And actors are basically just kind of using what they remember and what they kind of learned from that improv when they do the actual scripted movie. So it all starts off as improv, but at the end it is a scripted film. Long way of saying it.
So IMDb was full of shit. No, I'm just kidding.
Did you find that interesting on IMDb?
I'm very selective with the thumbs up I give out, because there are a lot of things where it's just either crap I don't care about or crap they could have made up. Like, I gotta, you know, how many of these people are verified? How do I know that Charlie Chaplin and Robert Downey Jr. weren't both up for the role of Iron Man, you know?
Yeah, that's true.
I read it was Morton Downey Jr., but bad source, so I'm not sure for sure.
Okay, so, this is a pretty serious movie overall, but, like, there's something kind of mildly annoying me throughout the whole thing, because, like, Roxanne looked like, she looked like someone, I was trying to figure out who. And this sounds like a mean joke, but it's not a mean joke. But she kind of looks like Robert Zadar a little bit. Like, because she had, like, her...
Ouch!
That is really mean.
Just like the her lower, like her jaw looks big.
And she looks like Quagmire from Family Guy, is what you're saying.
Yes.
I would say more, it's Robert Zadar big.
Okay. She's more attractive than Robert Zadar.
You're walking back on your comment here. I don't know.
Wait, what do you have against Robert Zadar? Did you see him in Samurai Cop? He's like in a bikini brief.
There, but not. But in general, no. But
trust me, he's got a chin on both ends. If you know what I mean. No, wait, what?
Rest in peace, Robert Zadar.
Chris Funderburg, my co-founder at the Pink Smoke, founded this term called the Mike Lee Special, which is a character who is in a Mike Lee film who just is angry at everyone and everything. You know, just can't. There's not even really a reason. It's just like everything. Everything is to blame except for that person. Everything is to blame for that person's unhappiness except themselves. David Thewlis's character, Naked, the main character, is sort of like the perfect example of that. But even more so, there's a character in Life is Sweet who is the daughter of this family, who is a perfect example. And this movie doesn't have a great example, but Roxanne is the closest to that, I think. Uh-huh. Just kind of, you know, sitting on the couch, smoking endlessly, and just everything her mother says is going to offend her one way or another. And she has just completely put this wall up between them, which when, you know, you see her reaction, her interactions with Cynthia, you kind of understand, because Cynthia is a little bit hard to take. And you can kind of see where that sort of developed and where it came from. But there's always a character in a Mike Lee film who's just full of hate, you know?
And I feel like Monica really is character. Like that too, though. I mean, we don't know exactly what's going on with her. We can kind of guess throughout the thing, but she's like relatively, or for most of her scenes, she seems to be in a bad mood, and she is kind of awkward around other people. And like, her relationship between Phyllis Logan and Timothy Spall is like strained in such a way where like you almost feel like you just want them to yell at each other and have it out to relieve whatever tension is going on there. You know,
and their scenes together were like at times unbearable for me, because it's like up until, you know, the big reveal, it's like, can they just relieve this tension? This is getting like a little too much.
Yeah, Monica is another Mike Lee staple, actually. The childless housewife. There's a lot of examples of these in his films. Who's Who, High Hopes, Grown Ups, Mean Time, Topsy Turvy. A lot of his characters are these women who, you know, kind of focus their energy on other things because they have no children to engage with or to have anything to do with. And, of course, Monica's is that she is cleaning this house, you know, because she's developed this sort of OCD sort of personality where the house always has to look perfect, and she's constantly buying plants for the house and tidying it up and changing things about it, and she's very proud to show it off when everyone comes over for the barbecue at the end. And of course that's rooted in a very deep unspoken unhappiness that she, as we learn at the end, is unable to have children. So it's something that is between her and Morris. It's this resentment that they have that they can't really talk about. And as he says, it's something that's almost destroyed their marriage because they can't confront it and can't kind of move on from it and make a decision beyond that. But that's, I wouldn't even say that's anger so much from her. I think it's just frustration. And also we learn she's having these health issues that are obviously very frustrating for her. So I think that sort of is on top of everything else, but she's a funny character though too. I love where she shouts at him, since when was Hoover in a spectator sport? You know, like she just really gets annoyed by him just sort of being there, which is a very married couple sort of relationship in general, I think. But it's just another thing that kind of naturally comes to a head by the end of the movie in a really satisfying way.
Yeah, and going back to Roxanne and Cynthia, like their dynamic is like I didn't know like when they said Cynthia was turning 21 for a while, I was thinking like that has to be a lie because she's acting like a 15-year-old this whole time. because their dynamic is just like purely that, like, teenager parent, like she's emotionally stunted, and you know, clearly has issues with her mom, is kind of in general, that are unspoken, that you know, it's like I lost my train of thought there.
Well, Cynthia is Roxanne, rather, as again, Mike Lee loves adult children living with their parents in movies, and those characters tend to be have shitty jobs, have no ambitions. You know, Roxanne constantly says she doesn't want to go to college. And but in this film, I think it kind of goes an extra mile, because we see through her relationship with Cynthia that she's basically repeating her mother's mistakes, more or less. And not only is she doing that, but she's being pushed towards that by Cynthia's behavior. Cynthia's so desperate for Roxanne not to emulate her bad decisions that she literally says to her, well, 1 minute she says to her, hey, if you had a baby, it'd be okay, I'd take care of it. And the next minute says, don't you be dropping a baby off on me, you know, like she's losing her mind. And she literally drives Cynthia to her boyfriend's apartment to have sex with him, you know, and like potentially get pregnant and have, you know, another baby out of wedlock, and set up another bad situation. I also love just watching it again this time that I never remember the boyfriend's name. He's such an unsubstantial character, but he has a barbed wire poster in his apartment. Nice little detail. I don't know if barbed wire was a Miramax movie or not. I don't know if they had the rights to have that up there, but I love that it's there.
Maybe it was his poster, the actor's. And whenever this movie brought up some very personal things that is kind of hard to watch at some points and just very uncomfortable. But like the one thing I will say on record is that whenever they would like argue, just like the intensity is like kind of like when my sister was a teenager and like the fights between my parents and my sister at the time, and only like this was easier because I wasn't there. Like I wasn't like, you know, around for it. Like this is kind of watching from outside. Like you have you know, like it's I don't know how to talk about this movie without sounding dumb.
It's a museum exhibit of your life that you recognize as a familiar situation, but is also kind of a fascinating, like almost like a scientific subject or something like that. Yeah, I mean, I get that. That's not, I don't think that's weird. You don't have to dance around your secret past as a international spy or whatever you're trying to hide from the audience. Don't worry.
Okay.
You make this like a Mike Lee film, Spencer. Let's just get it all out right here.
Yep, start crying.
I'd rather not. I haven't even talked about this thing in therapy. So it's kind of like that uncomfortable. Mm-hmm.
But obviously, that I think informed the background of this film. I'd search for identity, right? The who you are and kind of finding out what your background is. I think what they mention in the film about when the social worker played by Leslie Manville says, you know, these new laws have been passed, so now adopted children can go and look up their, literally go and look up their background, where they came from, who their birth mother was. Which was something in England, I guess, was for a long time, was not something that you could do. One thing that always strikes me in the film is the scene where she goes to look up the birth details in the library, the record library. And it always seems to me like there are way too many people in that library. too many extras, because they're like, there's barely any space to put one of the books down and look through it. But I guess if it was really that big a deal at that time that suddenly all these people were going back and we're finally had access to these records, there would be a lot of people there, that it would be something that some people were actually looking into.
Because what you said. But up until like, you know, the various character reveals, I was thinking like I wasn't trying to predict like the twist, quote unquote, but the whole time I was thinking like Hortense, like, because when I first I was thinking Hortense was probably like Tim's secret child or Monica's secret child. Because like I was, because going into it, I didn't know what to fully expect. Like I was expect, like my gut initially, gut feeling initially was like, oh, this will be kind of like a Almodovar like crazy melodrama, which in parts it kind of is a little bit. It dips into it, but it's still like very grounded and real. Doesn't have like that soap opera quality that like Almodovar plays with. But well, older Almodovar played with that. That current is a little more subdued. But
so when you saw the movie, you were wondering when Hortense was introduced whether she was Morris's daughter, possibly.
Yeah.
Okay, that's interesting because when this film came out, you know, it was nominated for all these Oscars. This is the first time I ever heard of it. You know, they splashed the whole thing of like, it's about a mom who has, a black daughter that she didn't know about. And they kind of played that up as the big angle of the movie. Mm. So it wasn't a surprise or anything. I always thought of it, at the time I thought of it as Michael Lee's sellout movie because it was mm-hmm. so acclaimed, you know, because it was winning at Cannes and got all these Oscar nominations. And I'm like, no, man, Mike Lee, he's naked, he's meantime, you know, he's a cool guy, not this adoption drama bullshit, you know. I had like this resentment against this film before even seeing it, you know, before even experiencing it. And still probably not even, if you count the TV movies, probably not even in my top 10 Mike Lee films, but it's still great. I mean, I still think it's fantastic and I love it. Might be that resentment from before just kicking in, I don't know.
Well, I'm glad you picked this over The English Patient, which I'm sure is fine, but I have no interest in watching The English Patient.
Oh, it fucking sucks.
That's what I always hear.
Even my mom hated that movie. I remember I saw that movie with my mom, thinking like, this is probably a safe film to take my mom to, and like we came out, she was like, holy shit, that was terrible. Like, wow. Well, who's the audience? Juliette Binoche's lovely, though.
And one of the, I think it's Elizabeth Barrington, who is the assistant. I think she's in that.
Jane.
There's someone in this movie who is also an English patient, but I can't remember which one.
She cracks me up in this movie when the scene where Stewart says his mother died while he was in Bangkok, and she makes that little sound like, "Oh." Just having her in the background at the end where she tells Morris, you're such a great guy. I wish I had a dad like you. A great addition to the film.
I mean, girl, I'm sorry, it's going to turn to this type of podcast briefly, but she kind of looks like Shelley Duvall a little bit. So, like, and she's the redhead, so I was like, oh, this is working for me right now.
You want a Robert Davi, Shelley Duvall sandwich, and I'm just not into it, man. I'm sorry.
Those two Shelley Duvalls with me in the middle. That's perfect.
Mm-hmm. This movie has both Mrs. Bennets that I'm familiar with, as in from Pride and Prejudice. It's the woman who is the essentially the main character, Brenda. How do you say your last name? Blethyn?
Blethyn.
That Monica?
She's Cynthia.
Cynthia. Cynthia plays Mrs. Bennett in the Keira Knightley Pride and Prejudice movie.
2005.
I recognized her and I couldn't figure out. I was like, where is she? Where is she? Oh, there she is. And I told Sarah. Wait. Sarah
that's
watched
the one
it with
me. That's the one with Matthew McFadden.
And I don't know who that is.
He's on Ripper Street.
Yeah, I don't know what that is either.
It was a show that was okay. That is very watchable.
What's a show? No. Okay. Never. Yeah, I'll take your word for it. Anyway, I said, oh, Mrs. Bennett is in this movie. And it was during the photo montage when we're seeing Timothy Spall do his job. And the woman who's grooming the dog starts grooming the dog. She's like, yeah, there she is. I was like, no, that's not her. I'm not talking to him. I'm talking about Mrs. Bennett. She like paused the movie and like pointed at her and was like, that's Mrs. Bennett. And I was like, I'm going to look up this lady just to see what the hell she's talking about. And she was totally right. The woman grooming the dog is Mrs. Bennett in the BBC series with Colin Firth.
Oh. Yeah, that's Ruth Sheen. She's one of Mike Lee's most frequent collaborators. She's in a ton of his movies.
She's got a special place in my heart because I've seen that Pride and Prejudice miniseries like 5 times. Sarah's seen it way more than me, but every time she puts it on, I'm like, ooh, I'm going to sit down and watch this.
Ruth Sheen is much more Shelley Duvall-like than Elizabeth Barrington, I would say Spencer. I know you'll see her very much in this movie, but if you go back and see High Hopes or All or Nothing that she's in, mm-hmm. she's got a very Shelley Duvall-ness to her.
All right, that means I have to watch those.
Yeah, especially High Hopes.
All right, thank you for that recommendation.
Happy to assist. Great.
Now Spencer's got something else to put in his spank bank. And
if you need any recommendations on Robert Divi, I could probably point you in the right direction there as well.
Okay.
Did you say Robert Davi?
I said Divi. I don't ever know how to say it.
We're talking about a different actor.
Which actor are you talking about?
Zadar.
Oh, Robert Zadar you're bringing up again? I thought you wanted Robert Divi in your Shelley Duvall sandwich.
Oh, did I say Robert Davi?
Yeah, you did.
Oh, apologies. They both have horrifying faces, Robert Davi and Robert
Zadar.
And they were both a Maniac Cop. Oh, see? Okay, it's not my fault.
Yeah, but one goes on Fox News and one is dead.
Well, one should be dead and the other one should still be alive, making Hell Comes to Frogtown Part 4.
Yeah, I agree with that. But in terms of like filmmaking, like I liked the montages in this because like this shows you like what their jobs are like, because you get the montage of Hortense. Do you get a montage of her page? I can't remember. You see here. I'm right going with this, but there was like the montage of all the people getting their pictures taken at the studio, and it's like I just found it like so serene and peaceful to seeing all different types. I was like, oh, this is just like his daily life, and some of those people, like I was thinking, like, okay, I bet some of these are going to come back later on, and I was kind of disappointed that that it never did initially, but there was a chubby kid with an X-Files t-shirt, or I think it was X-Files, but the way it looked pretty cool.
Oh, you talking about that kid that looked exactly like me? Yeah, I don't like that.
Oh, you don't?
I said to Sarah, I don't remember being in this movie, but there I am with my bowl cut and whatever else I was wearing back then. Yeah, don't like that.
T-shirt.
Yeah, I like those montages. That's kind of a... It's kind of weirdly experimental for a Mike Lee film, actually, to have that sequence in there. But I think it's thematically it's cool because, you know, you're obviously seeing people at their ideal best, right, when they get their portrait taken. And then so many of them, after it's done, are, you know, go back to being miserable.
And that comes back in one most... There are a couple of really tense scenes, and the scene with the... beauty consultant with the scarred face,
mm-hmm.
and like that felt like to me like a horror movie moment.
It reminds me of the scene from Peeping Tom. Do you know that one?
I know the movie, but I haven't seen it.
It's about a, you know, this guy who's a serial killer, but he's also a focus puller for a, you know, film company. But his thing is that he likes to record women that he's murdering, which he uses the tripod of his camera to kill them. It says a blade at the end of it. But his extra little flair is that he has this warped mirror on top of the camera, mounted on top of the camera, so that their face becomes horribly disfigured as he's killing them. And there's this one scene in the movie where I can't remember if he's... I think he has another job as a shooting photography at a modeling agency, and there's one woman who's been in an accident and has this legitimately disfigured face that he becomes obsessed with and wants to take her picture. And it's that being a horror movie, I think you're absolutely right. It reminds me of that scene from Michael Powell's Peeping Tom.
in this, like, when Morris was getting, like, closer to the pictures, it's like, something's going to happen. I don't know what's going to happen. What's going to happen? And, like, and he, like, snaps the flash, which he's not expecting it. And it's like, oh, this is going to turn deadly. It's like, oh, it doesn't, thank God. But still, it's like, I don't know.
He thought she was going to come back and kill him or something like that?
Yeah, this, like, that seems like this so tense. And I'm not sure how or why it was so tense, but it was just, like, a lot. It's like, I don't know, it was this, and there was another moment with him, with Morris, when he has the birthday cake, and he's walking down the hallway, and just thinking about that, this, like, made me think, like, oh, something bad's going to happen.
He's going to come around the corner and shoot them. I like the scene with the birthday cake, because I was that takes place right after the outdoor barbecue, and I said to Sarah, oh, this is obviously fiction. The sun is shining. And then during that scene, the rain is, like, pouring. It's lightning outside. It's like, see?
I'm referring to, like, the when he's walking down the hallway, when he's, like, facing the camera. This is something about that. It's like it was weirdly, I don't know. I feel like something really bad was going to happen.
Well, it probably is just the mounting tension of knowing that Hortense's identity is going to be revealed at some point during this. You know, that might have been the buildup from that. It's also, there's that long shot of them all in the backyard where they're all on one side of the table the entire time. Everyone's facing camera, which is, you know, calls back to the scene where Cynthia first meets Hortense, and they meet in the bar, and they're both sitting next to each other as opposed to across from each other. So you don't get the classic reverse shot sort of scene. It's just one shot of them on the same side of the table and having this sort of awkward looking back and forth at each other. So I think it's interesting because the birthday cake scene happens right after that long shot in the backyard where you've been looking at this same shot for so long. It's almost jarring to then kind of cut back to the inside of the house where it sort of goes back to being a regular movie. And, you know, you have regular shots playing out as you would assume that they would. So I don't know if that had anything to do with your personal experience of feeling anxious during that scene, but maybe could have something to do with it.
Yeah. That could be it. And, like, there's a recurring theme of what you talked about, like, happiness and, like, parents and children. And, like, another, like, theme, which I'm curious if this shows up in other Mike Lee stuff, but this is a major thing of sight and, like, and perception and, like, how you present yourself to people and, like, your family. And, like, you have the optometry angle, then you have him, the Morris being a photographer at the studio. And, like, the first time you see Roxanne is a picture of her when she's a child. And they say, like, that's the last time she smiled. It's like there's this whole thing of like this, sight and perception. If I was smarter, I'd be able to elaborate more on it. But like it does like seem like hammered into like every little part of the movie.
No, I think you nailed it. I think you're right. It's presentation, right? It's how we kind of show ourselves to others, like the portraits that Morris is taking. Everyone wants to look, you know, very well dressed and very put together and happy and in love, but, you know, we know that things are more complicated than that. It's interesting, the two sort of subplots that run along that line are obviously Cynthia having this sort of makeover when she meets Hortense and sort of caring about how she looks and sort of, you know, obviously feeling happier and changing her attitude. Someone once said to Mike Lee, it's almost like she's having an affair that she's hiding from Roxanne, you know, that she's kind of going off, and Roxanne even says at one point, maybe she's got a bloke, you know, like maybe it's a guy that she's with, because it's just rejuvenated her so much to have this other daughter who's successful and has had a, you know, had a college education and, you know, is someone who is obviously a very nice, very well put together person who, you know, despite her background has managed to have a good life. And the other subplot is Stuart, the former owner of Morris's studio who shows up, which is a scene apparently that the producers wanted out of the movie. They begged Mike Lee to take that out of the film because it, you know, slowed down the plots that had been set up and everything, but it's a perfect presentation. I mean, even Morris says as he's leaving there, but for the grace of God, you know, this is a guy who obviously, you know, things have not worked out well for him. His life is obviously not doing well. And he regrets the decisions he'd made. He comes and sees that Morris is perfectly happy, you know, in his life and in his business, and he resents him for it. And he's sort of this broken guy who is a creep on top of it. You know, all the women are, you know, really creeped out by him. So I think that kind of also speaks to, you know, either someone who is together and some versus someone who is falling apart and looks like a homeless person out on the bench in front of the studio.
Yeah, like, and that followed the really intense, like, photo, the portraits of the one with the scar. So it's like, you see him there, it's like, is that the guy who is responsible for it? Mm-hmm. So it's a nice little fake out.
Yeah, yeah.
Which, I guess, too late, but spoiler alert, but I guess you can't really spoil this. This isn't really, like, something you can spoil.
I mean, I already revealed everything about it. The movie.
We've already talked about the last scene.
Revealed this secret director's cut that you invented in your mind, Spencer. That's the most fascinating one so far.
Okay. So Joel, you didn't find were there any scenes that you thought were like very tense or very uncomfortable?
No, I mean, I felt so emotionally connected to Cynthia when the scene where Timothy Spall first goes to see her and she, you know, she just begins weeping uncontrollably and he's like holding on to her kind of, but it, like the camera does not break away and we keep watching this scene and it reminded me of the scene in 12 Years a Slave when Solomon is that Chiwetel Ejiofor's
Solomon Northup.
Yeah, when there's just that scene where the camera is like on his face, and I think he even looks at the camera, and it just kind of like holds for long enough for it almost to feel awkward. Like it's super effective that way, like a Pokemon. I don't know. Like I said, it's in some of the best acting I've ever seen. So. I didn't really feel tense at any moment, I could say.
Oh. Well, whenever Cynthia was very highly emotional and crying and whatnot, those things felt like straight out of like a Zulawski movie. Like it felt like you could insert Cynthia into Possession and it would make perfect sense. Although, Joel, you haven't seen Possession, so you don't know what I'm talking about.
Sam Neill.
Yeah, that movie. But it's about more than just the penis monster. There's a lot more going on.
I'm interested in Sam Neill exclusively. I don't care about this penis monster unless that penis monster is Sam Neill.
You only want to see Sam Neill fighting dinosaur monsters.
Yes, or ripping his own eyeballs out.
Or running for president or Senate. I can't remember.
The devil's running for president. He's just, you know, he's like the vehicle.
Something like that. I forgot which it was. It has a really great dog kill in it.
There's no such thing as a great dog kill. Oh, you mean the dog kills somebody?
The dog kills someone. Like he commands a dog. Cool. Yeah. Yeah. Omen 3. I went into it expecting it to be stupid. It's like, oh, this is pretty good. Pretty good movie.
I haven't seen it in a long time. I remember it being stupid, other than Sam Neill, but I should see it again.
Well, Sam Neill elevates it.
Of course, he's Sam Neill.
Yeah. And I wish I was hanging with him on his farm in New Zealand or wherever it is.
Oh, forget it, man. His tweets are like fantasy for me. Just want to be one of those pigs living with Sam Neill, rolling in the mud.
Yeah,
somewhere in New Zealand. That's the way to do it.
Right. So, J-Dog, did you have, like, besides Cynthia, like, what other characters did, like, you really connect with?
I keep talking about Timothy Spall. I think he does really good. They establish his character so well of, like, being somebody who knows how to make people smile, even just for an instant, with that montage. But also, there was some scene where he was talking to somebody, one of the other main characters, and he said something, and I, like, my reaction was like, oh, don't do that. Like, you're trying to get that thing to, like, get them to smile instead of feeling upset or whatever they're talking about. And I can't remember specifically when that happened, but, like, he encompasses that character so well. Like, but I mean, everybody's amazing in it. Marianne Jean-Baptiste is amazing in it. Like, seeing her, the scene with her and Leslie Manville, like, you almost feel like Leslie Manville is being mean to her, but she's really just trying to, like, protect her from the situations that have popped up before, you know, like, she's had to have this conversation so many times recently, probably, with people trying to discover, you know, where they came from, like, whatever their hidden motives are. Anyways, everyone is amazing in it.
That's another thing in a lot of Mike Leigh films. He's got a real disdain for, like, public figures and counselors, therapists, people like that, who, you know, have sort of a absurd sort of routine way of dealing with people, you know, where you kind of imagine it's the same over and over, even though they try to get it really into really intimate and personal. I think this is one of the more sympathetic portrayals. You know, Leslie Manville doesn't play her as ridiculous on the surface, although when she's, you know, busting out later and, you know, she has to get somewhere. Hortense is trying to, you know, get her attention. You can see that she's, you know, got other things going on, and it's not always going to be like, oh, no, I have time for you. I want to sit here and help you. It's like, no, I have to do my thing now. You know, you kind of get that impression. But funny thing about the Timothy Spall playing the photographer in this one, he's the star of Mike Leigh's film Mr. Turner from a few years ago, which is a phenomenal film. You guys definitely got to see it. But it's based on you know, J.M.W. Turner, the painter in the 19th century. And so one of the last scenes of the film is Turner posing for a photograph and with an early camera, photography being a pretty new invention at the time. And so his character is being photographed with this early camera, and he, throughout the film, he's been this gruff, groaning, hideous kind of a guy who has this permanent frown on his face, who doesn't smile, and he doesn't change that when he has his picture taken. It's just this, you know, sitting there going, how does this contraption work? And he's got this, you know, big frown on his face. So it's funny to think back to him playing this photographer in this film and trying to get everyone to smile and everything when he plays Turner.
I've never seen him play a normal character. Like, this is the first time I've ever seen him play just a guy.
It might be his most straight character ever. Yeah, even for a Mike Leigh film, absolutely.
Yeah.
Isn't he in a bunch of Harry Potter movies?
Yeah. You know, he's a rat man in those. So he's playing a thing. And the other thing I was thinking of is in Sweeney Todd, he's like I don't know what his job is there, but he's a bad guy.
He's the Beetle. He's Alan Rickman's Beetle movie. Yeah. Yeah, in the Harry Potter scene, in fact, when he and Gary Oldman and David Thewlis are all in the scene together, that's three Mike Leigh actors right there. Harry Potter movies love stealing Mike Leigh actors.
Mm. Well, steal from the best.
Oh, yeah, of course.
So, Fortune's friend, who shows up for the one scene, I was kind of hoping there'd be more of her.
Deanna, yeah, I think she's great, and I want to know more about their relationship.
Definitely.
Like, once she makes contact with Cynthia, Deanna is just out of the picture entirely. Which, I'm sure there's a longer cut with more of her in it, but, it was, would have been nice. Which, is that actress a Mike Leigh regular also?
She's had much smaller roles in two of his other films after this one, so she never had a scene as big as she had in this movie.
I heard she has a much bigger part in the horror movie cut of this.
Okay. I get it.
Secretions and lies? I don't know. What?
Yeah, like...
that's a different kind of movie now.
I'm in the dark. I'm in the dark. I don't know.
But there's a couple moments that shouldn't work, like the moment at 2 hours, 12 minutes when Timothy Spall says the title of the movie, which usually that's a sign of, oh, this is like this is trying too hard. It's like, oh no, this organically fits. It makes perfect sense. Like I noticed it, but didn't take me out of it.
Yeah, no, I think that moment's so emotionally charged that it works.
I didn't even notice it, so I think it was post birthday cake.
Yeah, it was during when everyone was crying after Roxanne came back inside the house. Mm.
You felt like it kind of wrapped up kind of neatly with all of them. Emotionally connecting. I like that Roxanne doesn't go and join them initially, at least.
Does anyone say happy-go-lucky and happy-go-lucky?
No. They say topsy-turvy-dum and topsy-turvy, but that's the only other example I can think of off the top of my head.
Okay. And so, somebody has to say naked and naked. I mean, that's just a word, right?
I don't think they do. I don't think it ever comes up. People do get naked and naked.
Excellent restraint.
But and Elizabeth Barrington's character in particular gets very abused in that film in a very uncomfortable way. Not like in this film.
Yeah. And with the costuming, it seemed like Monica was wearing a lot of blues and was kind of blending in to the house. And, like, she's, like, one with the house, basically. Because I don't think you see her outside the house, except for when she's buying flowers at one time. And for most part, she's kind of, like literally a part of it. And, like, you know, like, blends in with
Yeah, I noticed that her dress is, like, the wallpaper of the house. That's neat.
And Morris, he's dresses very blandly and kind of, like, like kind of like suburban dad-ish, but kind of like he's very like basic, normal-looking clothes. Or he like kind of like if it wasn't for like his face and like the emotion he's exuding, like he just completely blend into wherever he was.
Yeah, I mean, I think he just dresses like I do, honestly. No.
but
your shirts are too big, pants are too big.
Something that just seemed like this is purposeful in a way that I can't quite pick up on, but it definitely is like trying to like get something across.
I think it might speak a little bit to Morris coming from where he did, sort of his background. When you see that Cynthia is living in the same house that they grew up in, which is their parents' house, and that the house where their father lived until he died, and how it's obviously much more of a mess and where he lives, you know, and you can see that he kind of comes from this place where his parents were probably hoarders or something, and they had all this bric-a-brac lying everywhere, and they have plumbing issues and whatnot. And there's some guy hanging out with no t-shirt on in one of the houses in front.
the clothes thing wasn't a slight at you, John.
No, that's fine. I'm a complete slob. But I think, you know, it speaks, maybe, possibly, speaks to, you know, Morris coming from that sort of background and still kind of maintaining a little bit of it, even though he has moved up, he's kind of mobily moved upward in terms of where he is now.
Like, Hortense is very modern, and, like, she dresses very modern. This is, like, a lot of, like, cool, interesting stuff with, like, the color choices that was going on that, like, I feel like I need to watch this a few more times to like elaborate more on it. But on the hoarding thing, my grandparents are my grandpa is basically a hoarder. Like they keep like they still have decorations for Christmas from like the 60s, but a huge basement, so it's all organized. And so seeing, like, the house was like, oh, I'm kind of used to this.
Yeah. Let me tell you a story about hoarding from my town where I live. This guy passed away, and he was a notorious hoarder. He was lived alone. His wife had left up and left him like 20 years earlier, just one day just left. And so he was living by himself, and so when he died, they had to go into his house and take care of all this crap. I mean, all these newspapers from the last 30 years and all this other crap. And while they were cleaning all this out, they found his wife.
Oh, no.
In fact, had not abandoned him, but he had murdered and hidden in the wall behind the all this movie. Stuff. There you go. True story.
Jesus. When I say my grandpa's a hoarder, I just mean like...
Not that I'm accusing your grandfather of anything.
No. But he has like a books he's had for like 60 years and like Christmas decorations that he's had, like they've had for decades and like, that's what I mean. Like, and like, he has a huge record collection and stuff like that from like, just like stuff from the 50s.
So there's cool stuff like, too. It's not just Christmas decorations and stuff.
Yeah. Cool stuff. And apparently I'll get the books because I'm the only one who seems interested in the books of the grandchildren.
That's a good position to be in.
Oh, yeah, I'll gladly take his books. Although I want his record collection. He has some Curse Mayfield stuff for like original run like Curse Mayfield that I want to get. But we don't have to talk about that. So,
but Jill was saying that Marianne Jean-Baptiste is so good in this film and such a great personality. I think she absolutely glows in this film. Really, she's just whenever she's on screen, you just like watching her. You know. Just has a great aura about her in this film, even when she's, you know, confused or sad or when she's stuck in the middle of the big fight at the end of the movie. I don't know. For me, I love seeing her in this film.
Yeah, she's the most fun character, even though, like, her emotional journey is, you know, very challenging, complex, but, like, she still is, like, the, just, like, the easiest person, to experience in the movie.
Yeah, I mean, I just love when she makes the goofy faces to Cynthia when they get together and makes Cynthia laugh. Just has, and the way she laughs when Cynthia makes the joke about, you know, I'm ravishing, you know? It's just, she just has like a natural just sort of charm to her that's really just radiant, I think. So a huge highlight of the film for me. I think maybe Cynthia might be a more fun character just because Brenda Blethyn really just sends her off the deep end, you know, with her crying fits and things like that, and how she could just barely talk into the phone. And again, the way she kind of switches gears with her with Roxanne all the time.
Their fights, I said, were uncomfortable. Also, they're pretty funny. Because, like, that's how definitely absurdly, like, mean they were with each other.
Yeah, definitely. That's something Mike Lee does very well, is mothers and daughters who can't fucking stand each other. There's this 17-minute short he did called The Short and Curly. It's one of my very favorite things that he did. It's on the Naked Criterion collection, I think, disc. But it's got David Thewlis in it and Alison Steadman, who was Mike Lee's wife for a long time, are the stars of it. But it's this hairdresser mother who just talks incessantly, just cannot stop talking, and her daughter just clearly hates her and would just love to murder her. And it's, again, it's only 17 minutes short, but it's delightful.
J-Dog, you got anything left you want to bring up?
No, not really. I feel like I need to watch the movie a couple more times. Like, I feel like if somebody's... I feel like it would be a good acting, reference for anybody who wants to be an actor and is serious about it. Like, the people reaching these emotional depths in the movies is just kind of astonishing to me. Because I'm not used to seeing anything but more, vapid's not the right word, but, like, just things that are more surface level, not getting into, like, what real life is like. And considering the time period we're living in right now, I'm not sure that people necessarily need another dose of real life. But I think if you're somebody who wants to be an actor or has experience acting already and stuff like that, that you should definitely be watching this movie. And it sounds like the rest of Mike Lee's movies also.
Can only benefit from watching Mike Lee, I'll tell you that.
I definitely will be checking out more Mike Lee after this. And I wish this one was more easily available, because I don't have Criterion Channel or some of the other ones, like HBO Max, so I kind of had to go through some other means to get a hold of it. And like the DVD is kind of out of print and super expensive. But
it's surprising, since this was such a huge deal when it came out, that now this is the hard one to find and Criterion hasn't put it out on disc or anything like that. It was a super huge deal in 96.
Because I assumed, like, because Naked was on Criterion, so I was like, oh, this must be on Criterion disc too. I was like, oh, it's not. So I was a little annoyed, but I don't. It seems to be a thing with, like, the Cannes winners seem to get forgotten more than, like, the Oscar winners. At least the ones that we've covered, I feel like.
I think that they all get forgotten,
I feel like unfortunately. I think the Cannes winners get forgotten quicker than Oscar winners.
Speaking of Cannes, there's another little anecdote. Timothy Spall was supposed to go with Mike Lee to Cannes to premiere the film, and he started having some chest heaviness and was debating whether or not he should stay behind and get checked out or if he should go to France. And Mike Lee and everyone else was like, stay here, obviously, and get looked at after. And it's a good thing he did, because he would have died had he not gotten immediate treatment. He had, like, a serious heart issue that was, they had to operate immediately. So if he had chucked him and been like, it's not a big deal, and gone to Cannes with him, he probably would not be alive today. So glad that he chose to stay behind. And speaking of Timothy Spall, if you guys end up watching, just to make this all relevant to the topic of your current podcast, Timothy Spall has a great performance in Life is Sweet, playing this really insane character named Aubrey, who dresses ridiculously. And I think Chris once said he dresses exactly like Morris Blackman, like a white person emulating like a Spike Lee character would think looks cool on him, and it absolutely does not.
And Girl 6 was filmed out of competition at Cannes that year also.
Interesting.
Yeah. Interesting. Okay, so as always, I'll bring up the thing that when I was on FlixWise Canada for A Screaming Man, Kester kind of said, like, oh, the grand prize winner is sometimes better than Palme d'Or. The grand prize winner of this one, of this year, was Breaking the Waves, a Von Trier movie. And I have not seen that. That's one. That's next one on my list. I kind of took a break from Lars after like three or four in a row.
Yeah, that's the one to see.
Yeah, I've been getting back on, just like, you know, his movies are a lot to deal with. And I may have to think of marathoning a couple in a row.
Yeah, this was no exception. It's a tough movie, but it's great. It's definitely my favorite of his films, I think.
So far, my favorite is House That Jack Built.
Really?
I've only seen, like, the first two in the last few, and like a couple in the middle. If I'm just going off, like, I like him from the first two, definitely. The first two are kind of more interesting than good, but they're also kind of good. Well, not the second one, the Epidemic one kind of is meh until the last 20 minutes. But this was 1990. And we'll do, like, the comparison with Spike next episode. Well, previous episode. We haven't watched Girl 6 yet, is what I'm trying to say. So when we watch Girl 6, we'll figure out if there's anything to compare with these two, which I have a feeling there won't be much.
Nothing jumps up in my mind to compare the two movies. Other than their Prince soundtracks, of course.
Anyway, so this is 1996. A pretty good year for movies. So, starting with a guest, what would you recommend for this year?
I'd recommend The Long Kiss Goodnight. The Shane Black written, Rennie Harlan directed film starring Gina Davis and Samuel L. Jackson. I think it's a great fusion of, you know, kind of an old crime adventure with modern, you know, action approach to it. It's a fun, funny, interesting film, and another film about identity, you know, kind of finding out who you are and, you know, if the person that you used to be has anything to do with who you've become, you know, which is sort of the Gina Davis arc in this film. And of course, since it's Shane Black, there's a Christmas scene.
That guy loves Christmas.
He does. That is one I would recommend. I just recently rewatched Abel Ferrara's The Funeral, which I didn't like at the time. Maybe because it was just like a glut of gangster type movies, you know, kind of post Goodfellas, post Tarantino. And I sort of grouped it in with that, like, ah, yeah, that's just another one of them guys throwing around, you know, pointing guns in each other's faces, bullshit. But watching it recently, it's actually pretty great. It's great performances by Chris Walken and Chris Penn, I'd forgotten, is so fucking good in this movie, even though the female cast, which is great, Isabella Rossellini, who else? I can't think of her name. From Hand That Rocks the Cradle, I'm suddenly going blank here. Annabelle Sciorra. Are great in the film. Unfortunately, they don't have much to do, but it's still a pretty interesting, very different kind of film. And strangely for Ferrara, too, it seems like a very sort of classy affair that I'm surprised didn't do something for him at the time, like get him sort of bigger projects. Although I'm happy with where his career progressed from that point on. It's kind of surprising that it didn't get more notice at the time.
Yes, I've never heard anyone even talk about, but I've only seen like the early-ish stuff, because the later stuff I want to see, but it's kind of hard to get a copy of some of the later, more current stuff, unfortunately.
Mm-hmm. And Chris isn't here, but I'm sure if he was, he would say that he would recommend Hellraiser Bloodline.
That space one?
The space one. That is a joke. He wrote an article about it for the website that was less than glowing. So he's not actually a fan. Oh, Keith Gordon's movie is adaptation of Kurt Vonnegut, Mother Night, with Nick Nolte, is another really underrated film from this year. Surprisingly really good adaptation of the very good book. Nolte's great in it, and it's... I don't even want to say too much about it because it's like there's a lot of spoilers, but that's a movie that does not get talked about enough and people should see it.
You talk about The Sexiest Man Alive, 1992?
His last name is Nolte and his first name is Nick, and that's exactly who I'm talking about.
Yeah, I looked it up. It's really, really weird that he was voted Sexiest Man Alive at one point, but he was.
Based on the strength of Free Fugitives, I'm sure.
I think it was Prince of Tides came out.
Oh, right, right, right. It's not particularly sexy in that movie. I don't know if sexy is the word I would pick.
But, J-Dog, what about you?
I don't know. There's a bunch of random stuff there. Like, Head of the Family? No, I gotta talk about that. The Frighteners? No. Okay, so we covered 5 movies from this year on the science fiction podcast, Please Don't Send Me Into Outer Space. So let me just quickly go through those, because I don't think we've done anything with this year before.
Not yet.
Okay. So start with Sabrina, the Teenage Witch, which was a TV movie made as a pilot before that TV show came out with Melissa Joan Hart. I've never actually seen the TV show, but the movie is weirdly horny.
What?
Uncomfortably horny, and I think it's because the director, Tibor Takacs, has other things that are also... Yeah, kind of sleazy B movie style.
Yeah,
it was a fun movie to watch.
I used to love that show as a kid. I haven't seen it since like maybe middle school. I'm sure it has not aged well.
Yeah, who knows? Armitage 3, which was just an anime movie that came out around anime movie time, which I consider it the Ghost in the Shell time to be anime movie time. It was fine. God of Cookery, which is, I think, an underseen movie by Stephen Chow, which has the same martial arts antics that he has in most of his movies. This one just happens to be about a man who was the best cook, TV cook, I think, in the world, and then he somehow loses his position. He has to go train and stuff like that. And there's a big showdown at the end, which was very funny.
What's up with kung fu artists in the late 90s being TV cooks? Didn't Jackie Chan do that in Mr. Nice Guy as well?
Yeah, I guess they were all up on that cooking show stuff before it became the phenomena it still is here.
Huh.
I'm not sure. Mary Jane's Not a Virgin Anymore. Anyways, going on to the next movie.
Hey, it's a great movie.
Listen, for 1 month, for the years we were doing the podcast, we would pick movies to watch during the summer that were like summertime fun kids movies, I asked Spencer to pick a movie, and he picked Mary Jane's Not a Virgin Anymore, which is before Clerks, but that's probably the easiest thing to compare it to.
And it's after.
Oh, is it?
Yeah, a couple of years after.
Okay. It just feels better than that. And it's by Sarah Jacobson, who died very early. She only had two movies, I believe.
One short film and one feature film. Mm-hmm. Both are really good.
You can buy the disc set from AGFA.
I highly recommend both of them.
Mm-hmm. And, you should watch that if you haven't seen it. And the last one is Star Trek First Contact, which is one of the best Star Trek movies, definitely the best of the next-gen movies. Oh, my God, my cat just put her nail directly into my back. Ow!
Oh.
Anyways, Jean-Luc Picard showing off his guns in the movie. Very good.
I do love Alice Cridge. In anything.
You take it.
What's that?
Alice Cridge, who plays the Borg Queen. I'm a big fan.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I'm not familiar with that actress other than the Borg Queen, but, like, she's so good.
A little movie called Sleepwalkers, my friend. You never seen it?
I haven't. Oh.
Get me on your podcast, my friend. We will talk about Sleepwalkers.
Oh, hell yeah. I'm writing it down.
Okay, for me, 1996, Watermelon Woman, that was intended to be an episode of this podcast, but I'll be frank and like reveal a little behind the scenes. That's a movie about a black lesbian and her experience as a black lesbian, and having two straight dudes talking about a lesbian movie is kind of like, it wouldn't feel right, so I kind of never found a right guest for it, and it's kind of underseen because I'm surprised how many people have not heard of it. It's kind of well known, but whatever. It's really good. It's shot in Philly. We get a lot of Philly stuff. Some stuff I recognize because some stuff has changed since the mid '90s. But, yeah, it's a nice little funny relationship drama slash kind of like a finding your place in history type thing. And it kind of plays with fiction and reality in some really fun ways. And Kingpin, it's
let me just say that is a great movie. That came up in trivia night the other night. Martin Kessler and I are on a trivia team. We play online. And
what came up?
Watermelon Woman. They had a it was a still. They showed stills from New Queer Cinema, and Watermelon Woman was one of them.
I could not find anyone who wanted to talk about it, but anyway, Kingpin, great comedy. It's hilarious. It's the Fairley Brothers one about bowling, and you get this is like the low point for Bill Murray, but Bill Murray is the best, like one of the best parts of the movie, and you get a Randy Quaid as an Amish guy. It's really stupid, but it makes you laugh. I think it's better than Dumb and Dumber. It definitely has aged better. That movie's kind of alright, but I don't think it's that good. But Kingpin is like, I don't think they ever did better than Kingpin, personally.
Kingpin's probably the movie that I know the most about that I've never actually seen.
If you like to laugh, I recommend it.
I'll have to get around to it sometime.
It's not, Joel's a comedy, so I don't know if you'll ever watch it.
But I like to laugh.
Do you?
Yeah.
Okay. And the last one is Supermarket Woman. It's the second to last Juzo Utami movie. It's kind of a typical late era Juzo Utami. It's very specifically Japanese, and it's not the most universal thing in the world, but it's still good if you can get into it. But some of it is like kind of like it also feel like a follow up kind of to Tampopo, dealing with food and our relationship with food. But in this case, it's supermarkets and the relationship of like the people who work there and the people who shop there and how to run a supermarket. And, you know, it's a little like the process of this is how you do things the correct way. But it makes it a really good, funny movie. And, he died mysteriously the next year. But that's a topic for another time. Musain, the Safi Faye film. I haven't seen Safi Faye movies because they're kind of hard to actually find, but she was a contemporary of Mbeti and Simbin, and she recently had a film festival in New York, I think 2 years ago, maybe 1 year ago, where she actually did show up in person and they showed some of her movies, but I couldn't make it. I found out like the day that she was actually going to show up, but I just want to highlight her because she's one of the first black female directors to have a theatrical run in Senegal in the mid-70s, but like a lot of African films from that era, it's really like 50-50 if there's even like a VHS release of it out there. And I'm surprised Criterion hasn't picked up Safi Faye stuff yet, or like Kino or someone has tried to like scoop, or maybe they have. And it's, but anyway, like, just want to highlight Safi Faye. She's still alive, so there's still time, you know, if you want to, for those people to, you know, do a commentary or interview with her or whatever, if they want to have a talk to the person behind it. But, yeah, that's it. John, thank you for coming on.
Thanks for having me, guys. Glad that with this episode you get to break your Mike Lee cherry, and I hope that you will watch a lot more of his movies. He's phenomenal.
I definitely will. And J-Dog, this comes out in late August. Will the other thing be ready?
Or, well, first of all, yes, the Vampire Podcast better be damn published by then. Mm-hmm. You know, it's a, I've been teasing it enough time for this to happen. So that we should have Dead Travel Fast podcast, the first three episodes. If I can get all three of them up, then at least the first episode should be up. Then. Dead Travels Fast, or Dead Travel Fast is the name of that podcast.
Yeah,
it's got me, Spencer, Sarah. Yeah, talking vampires.
Talk to my friend about, you know, getting the music done.
Please ask him if he has the time. If not, I'm just going to take some popular piece of music or something like that, because that's literally the only thing that's holding me back.
I'll ask him tomorrow if the progress on it. Okay. Anyway, so...
Wait. I'd also like to mention I have a different podcast that I'm doing that I'm just going to have random people on called... customers also watched a Prime Watch Along podcast wherein I will pick a movie to start with. For instance, the first movie we started with was Train to Busan, and I will have guests on to talk about that movie. And the whole premise of this podcast is that at the bottom of the page, after when you pick something on Amazon Prime, it's always customers always watched or also watched. And sometimes it's like movies you've never heard of, or weird documentary, or sometimes it is another classic movie. But if you click on that, you start to get this chain going. And that's what this podcast is really going to be about, studying these chains of, like, how are these movies related? Like, you know, how are the chains created? Like, and what determines what Amazon and Lord Bezos is going to recommend to us, you know? So that's should be... By the time this comes out on all the regular podcast places, okay. Customers also watched.
Right. John, Pink Smoke stuff coming up next month when this comes out.
Yeah, we've got some exciting stuff coming up. We're kind of retooling our Patreon right now, so it's going to be more based on one big incentive every month. And we've got new stuff coming up from Martin Kessler, from Marcus Penn, and I'm going to be tackling my first audio commentary ever for a movie. So I'm kind of excited to try that up. And
ooh, RoboCop 3?
I could definitely tackle RoboCop 3. It's a 1990 made-for-TV, made-for-USA Network movie called I'm Dangerous Tonight, directed by Toby Hooper, about... A fabric taken from an ancient Aztec burial shroud that is then sewn into a cocktail dress, and it possesses the person who wears it with evil.
Wow.
Yeah. It is every bit as fun as
fascinating.
It's been great to research it. It's funny because I've been talking to people who've done audio commentaries, and I've been warned away from going too far down rabbit holes in research, and it's absolutely true. Like, when you start following one lead and you just find another and another, you can literally just go on forever finding out all these interesting obscure facts and connections and whatnot, and at some point you just gotta say, I just gotta put this together and then do this thing, you know. I can't be tracing Aztec shrouds turned into evil cocktail dresses for the rest of my natural life. So,
For me coming up, I think my next Grindbin episode might be up by then. I recorded one on Street Trash with them, because that's like, I will say on an episode, I don't really like body horror movies at all, but Street Trash is kind of the few that I like. And yeah, I know it's stupid and offensive and kind of a bad movie, but I find the movie just weirdly charming, and it's like a weird little like 80s horror comedy sort of thing, and it's gross, but not gross in a way where I want to vomit like Brian Yuza movies tend to be for me. But yeah, I'll be talking about Street Trash on a grind bin maybe around the time this comes out. And
very cool.
Yeah. A month or two ago, I was on Cinema Parlor talking about The Baby. I'm eternally grateful for Melanie giving me the opportunity to gush about one of my favorite movies ever. And from here, we gush about The Baby and how it's campy nonsense, but it's campy nonsense that I love every frame of. Listen to that. It's on SoundCloud and iTunes and all the usual places.
Did you say that's your favorite TED Post movie?
Gush and The Baby at the same time.
No. It's a gross movie. Deal with it. It's perfect in my eyes.
I hope your guys' next podcast is called Gushing on the Baby.
Gushing around with Joel and the Baby.
And also by the time this comes out, maybe I'll be back on writing for my site, Jailhouse 701, Jeffrey's Cult Cinema. I don't know yet. And my other site, After History, maybe I'll have something up. It depends on how soon the next semester school starts. So who knows? But you can check out Jailhouse 701, Jeffrey's Cult Cinema, for the other like reviews I've written over the past couple of years. The early ones are I don't feel too proud about. I should come back and change. But I might do that. I might not. I don't know yet. But yeah, so next episode is the start of the 1986 pairing, which is She's Gotta Have It, the movie, with a Platoon. And the She's Gotta Have It will have Jared Gilman returning for a third time. That'll be a fun one because he hasn't seen too many Spike Lee movies. And hopeful guest Lan, on Twitter, she's Lan L, I think. I can't remember. Anyway, a friend of mine will be on for Platoon. And that's it. See you guys next time for whatever comes out next.
The show's email is highandlowpod@gmail.com. It made no sense to change email, so it's the same feed. The show can be found at podbean.com, and Spotify, and other places you can find podcasts. Please rate and review whenever possible. The logo is by Josh Hollis. The music is by James Fell. And thank you for listening.